This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, can everyone hear me and everything like that? Yep, okay. So we will go ahead and get started here. Before we get started, I've been trying to think of the best way to kind of plan of attack or find some sort of strategy around addressing, you know, all the comments and everything like that in the code, in the kind of the procedures that we've been walking through. And I was thinking, and so this is my idea, and feel free to give your thoughts on this idea, and all of that stuff. So my idea is basically, you know, if we can go all day long, you know, on this current set of procedures and everything like that, and people can say, well, I like this over this part, I like this part over this part, blah, 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 blah. We could do that. But ultimately, you know, most of the stuff that we talk about will have to be given to the UA, you know, like if every vote is that 5-5, 6-4 kind of breakdown, everything just kind of goes to the UA in general, and the UA makes those decisions. And I'm not saying those conversations here aren't useful to everyone's, you know, viewpoint, aren't useful to informing our viewpoints and everything like that, but it just seems like, you know, we shouldn't, like, we don't have to sit there and just kind of whack each other, you know, for like hours on end. So my idea is this. If people, you know, as it currently stands with a couple modifications to complete it, if people are okay with, you know, the current set of procedures that Gabrielle and Risa wrote and said, you know what, we like a lot of this, a lot of this makes sense to us, then we can go ahead and, you know, say that's the version we can put out, but we could also have a supplementary document that people can sign on to and say, but we have specific, you know, concerns about this thing, and this thing that we want the UA to consider in this process. And as many people can, you know, put their name or put their vote next to a specific concern and say 6 people or 5 people have a concern about this part of the procedures that we want people to consider. And we, here's the alternative. And we don't have to sit there and just run through the procedures and just whack each other, because I don't think that's beneficial to anyone, because that's actually not, we could just, you know, get those same votes anyhow. And no matter what, we would produce that document. But I think upfront, if we can just, you know, sit down and say, you know, we like a lot of this procedures, we think a lot of this makes sense, here are the concerns that we have, and we sound concerns right now, because no matter what, we would have to be doing that. And I think that saves us time, so that we don't have to sit, you know, today for a very long period of time, and we don't have to sit tomorrow for a very long period of time. That's my initial idea. You know, regardless, we're going to have we're going to have something like that. But I think if we just address it upfront, this meeting, I think we can save time and save the energy, and also both those things will go to that public comment, because I think that then people can weigh in, and people are going to weigh in regardless with that same type of information. So I'm happy. I'm going to let people say a couple thoughts on that, see if people like it. And then if you don't like it, feel free. It's an idea that, you know, I have. I typically get this way. Laura, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't mind that idea. I've been thinking a lot about how to move forward a little faster than we are. And I have to say that as a non-specialist in this, I really, really appreciate the comments of Gabrielle and Christina and Barbara and Risa and other people who are a little bit more knowledgeable about how the process currently works and how it's worked in the past. But I sort of feel like maybe, at least for myself, we're kind of doing the same thing over and over. And I would sort of like to hear the arguments and vote and hear the arguments and vote. You know, I mean, that's sort of how I'm feeling about it. And maybe that's naive, but, you know, at a certain point, it'd be nice to have the content experts stop and let the people who are listening and have voting responsibility, just then vote.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of my idea with this document. It's just, it seems like there's the comments and the way, and any kind of like, here's my viewpoint type of thing, that's the vote, you know, like those are the things that we would have reported anyhow when we did, when we would vote on a specific section. So you say, or so I say, I don't know, brain's not working yet. Any other thoughts on this? Gabrielle, yeah.
I'm just trying to clarify, I think, what you're saying. So would there be any sort of walkthrough of the document during the meeting? Or would it be everyone's responsibility to kind of fill this in on their own?
I think what we can do is, we can take the comments, you know, that everyone has put on the Google Doc and stuff like that, and kind of break them out into a separate document. And people can put their name underneath that section saying, yeah, I think I support this idea. I support this idea instead of what we currently have in, you know, the draft set of procedures, and that would be it. All right, and, you know, every comment would have a varying vote. So some, you know, if there was one comment that, you know, six people said, yeah, we think this should change, then that comment, you know, would have like six next to it. Six members of the CJC believe that this is a really important concern, you know, blah, 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 that should be changed. And out of whatever number of voting, 6 out of 10, you know, be the voting number. And then that document would be posted. So basically that document would have to kind of be created, and then members would look through it, put their name next to it, or just put a tally next to it. So that would be it.
I guess if I can just follow up, my only hesitation with that then is, like, the document as is, it doesn't really have like the comments or the, like, there's a lot of assumptions and justifications embedded in the, like, choices of the draft itself, but none of that is in the comments because the comments are responding to the draft. So I guess to me, it seems like somewhat difficult to, like, explain or justify the choices if it's just like the responses, if that makes sense. I'm not sure if it makes sense.
Yeah, I get it definitely makes sense. I think my thing, it would almost be like, oh, like, are you trying to say, like, potential response to a comment, be like, you know, here's why we made this, like, of the people that, you know, wrote the procedure, like, who support the current set of draft procedures, like a response as to why you believe that to be the case. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And I think that if we want, we could, I'm trying to make sure that we can have a document that, yeah, let me think on that point, because I think that point's really important, and I'll let Risa go for it.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so first, I think we need to have a document from this committee, not something we send and say, well, we're kind of split in lots and lots of places, and so we don't really have a recommendation. I mean, for example, I don't like the vote that we took, you know, with regard to preponderance of evidence, but we have a position from the committee, a 6-4 position on that important point. And maybe that's consistent with what you're saying, but I do think we need a cohesive document that we send and say, this has been vetted by, and we have a position from this committee, and it may be that it's split, and that says something, but I think we need to do that as a document, not just a bunch of comments. It's just going to confuse people. It confuses me when I go through and there's just a lot of comments, you know, and I know this stuff well. So, so I think that, you know, we've got today, we've got quite a few hours tomorrow, as much as, you know, none of us wants to put a Saturday into it, you know, especially with the need we have, I think, for all of us to let our brains kind of, you know, come down from over screen, you know, over exposure to screens. But it seems to me that what we could do is to say, are there certain things we agree on? I think some of those comments are quite small, you know, it has to do with wording or something like that. And we can work on, you know, on just getting agreement on wording. There are other ones which are more philosophical. You know, we've talked about the standard of proof. There's a question of how active should the counsel or advisor be on behalf of the people. Should we have the separate administrative panel? You know, there are differences in whether to do that, and if we do that, how to do that. You know, there are some actual substantive things, I think, going back to what Laura said, that we can talk about, say what are the real substantive debates, and vote on what we think we should do with that. And then if we can do, I think, a good bit of that today, you know, on the kind of those philosophical substantive positions, then between today and tomorrow, I've been thinking that I can't think of a better way to spend my Friday than, you know, working on, you know, maybe it's some things are too legalistic sounding to people, you know, just making them perhaps more plain language or, you know, that kind of thing, so that tomorrow we can start with knowing where the position is of the group on those bigger pieces. And then I think we can send a document that's basically from this committee for public comment, and that it can show where there are differences philosophically, and we can move forward.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Gabrielle?
I was just going to say, I think that if the committee doesn't have a cohesive document, that's going to make public comments very, very difficult. And we're already trying to be cognizant of like students having to do this during this time and virtually. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, even if what you send to the UA is like, it could be the original document that was up here for the procedures, and then whatever, you know, goes up for public comment, so that the UA can see like what the changes were between those two documents without, I guess, confusing students even more.
Yeah, Bryce, and then Barb. So
sorry, did you call me?
Yeah, that's okay. So Bryce, then Barb. Thanks. So personally, I think that I agree with the points made and that we should produce a document. I think that, you know, an important part of a kind of democratic process is that we respect our points of disagreement and that we allow some kind of standard, in this case, a majority vote, to carry forward. That's vital to the functioning of all democratic bodies, and it's failing in some places, and we don't, I think we have the opportunity to say, look, we disagree about standard of proof, for example, but burden of proof, but, you know, we can live with the outcome either way, but we don't want to not have a voice and to, you know, lose our chance to have a say in this. So I think we should produce a majority report if we can, and I think we can. And then I think if people feel strongly enough about some of the disagreements, then we could also produce a minority report or just, you know, a separate summary of some of the points of contention. And then that would be easier to read maybe than going through something with comments. So I think what we should submit to the assembly is what the majority of us agree upon as best as possible. And I think there will be a fairly coherent majority and close to consensus on much of the document, which is reassuring. And if we feel strongly enough, if some minorities on some points feel strongly enough, then we should produce a second document that summarizes those points of disagreement.
Yeah, and I think that is what I'm going towards. I think in my initial thing, I think that was the idea that I wanted to verbalize, and perhaps I didn't verbalize it the best way possible in presenting the idea, but that's exactly what I'm going towards. I just wanted to kind of put everyone on that kind of framework of thinking before we started today, because I think that, you know, if we put ourselves in that mindset, I think it allows people to have the better discussion and also, like, you know, get into the mindset of voting that I've kind of been struggling to kind of frame the best. But Barb, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really, really sorry. I had some audio challenges at the beginning. I had to log out, log in. So I actually didn't hear your initial proposal, Joe, but not to belabor it, I gather you were proposing some kind of shortened version of, or trying to find a way to figure out what the initial consensus is on the document as drafted. And then if there's support for that, maybe we're done. Did I understand that correctly, or? I'm sorry.
I think I missed in saying that. I think I implied that without kind of stating it outright. I think I made an assumption of my own logic. So, I mean, that is also like an option for the committee. If like the committee wants to kind of say as it stands now with like minor additions and stuff like that to fill it out, if people are okay with the set of procedures and taking that vote, I'm happy to entertain that vote for people. I obviously don't want to be the person to initiate it, but if people don't want to do it, I'm totally okay with not doing it. You know, I can't force the committee to go out and do something. But I think, yeah, if you want to continue, Barb, sorry.
Yeah, I think just my one follow-up is, I hear the comment, I feel like I'm talking too much in these meetings. I'm not a voting member. And yet I feel like it's important for this committee to hear kind of hear from the people who practice with this document day in and day out now. So if there's a sense that our office is talking too much, our comments are in the document and provide a good starting point. Assuming everybody's read those, I will try to say less during this meeting, answer questions. What I don't want to have happen out of this is for, and I'm mindful of the petition that is out there, our office isn't proposing anything. We are responding to drafts that others have prepared, and we're trying to offer insights based on our experience and in, you know, in-depth knowledge of the way the office works on a day-to-day basis. I think it's important for this committee to hear that, but you all can tell me to shut up, you're talking too much, and I will respect that.
All right, Risa, and then we'll go to the document.
Yeah, thanks. What petition?
So there's a petition amongst some undergrads that I've seen minorly circulated. It's definitely not to the level of other petitions I've seen during my time in shared governance. There's a petition that implies that the OJA has created a set of proposals in which this undergraduate student body does not agree with the fact that, or people who sign the petition does not agree with the fact that advisors are not allowed to speak and that there would be no cross-examination of witnesses during a hearing. That's the two points that this petition states, that, you know, people who sign on to it, you know, say we don't want these things to be taken away. I have not, you know, received any petition from any of the organizers. I have not, you know, I've not even received emails over this petition. So, I mean, from what I see, it's definitely in like the first stages of its lifespan. But, you know, as the chair of this committee, I haven't received anything yet, but I've seen it circulating. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Well, I mean, as the document stands at this point, of course, neither of those things is the case.
Yeah.
It may be the OJA's position, but it's not the case as the document currently stands. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is definitely, that was a point of concern that I had, and I was kind of worried about it if it grew in larger, because I worry about misinformation to a certain degree. But we will go into the document and kind of, there's either one or two ways we could continue going through the comments, or we could just start taking votes. I'm of the position we should just start taking votes on the things and start rolling through it that way, you know, get a couple comments and then vote on it, vote on, you know, section, because I think that's the only way we can kind of go for it, if that's okay with everyone.
Yeah, can I just add one other thing, Joe, real quick?
Yeah, of course.
The point in terms of participation, I was thinking about this before today's meeting, that you know, I really hope that all the students on the committee will speak on, you know, their positions, because I do think that what can happen when people who are working with certain things, you know, day in and day out talk about them, is that it becomes unintentionally, you know, a situation where others don't feel that they don't know enough to speak. And I think that you know, the point that you were, the information about this petition means that people do care about this, and the people who care about it are the students, and they're the ones who are going to be affected by it. So I hope that who's ever on the committee, you know, all the voting members, who, and of course that applies to anybody who's a voting member, including, you know, staff and faculty, but I do hope the students speak up.
Yeah, for sure. So we will go to the document. I will share my screen. Let's see. I hate doing share screen. I'm always worried that something will be open behind it that I'm like embarrassed of, but I don't think I have anything embarrassing. No, just my Twitter.
You could just share an individual window, Joseph.
Yeah. I figured it out. Yep. There we go. It's just the part of my other tabs open, but that's okay. I don't think anything's big there. Okay. So kind of how we'll go through this is that each kind of big comment, I think there's a whole sections via respondent. We'll talk to her a couple minutes about it. We'll go for it, and then we'll go for a vote. And kind of I'll record that as we go on. And I think that's the way we can handle it. Sorry, I'm going to find a piece of paper. Okay, so I'm going to give this kind of section of discussion until 9:40, and then we'll move down the document, and I'll set the time parameters for everything. So if people want to, you know, go for talking about respondents and kind of the thought process of having respondents be able to talk during the meetings, you know, we'll do that as the first vote, if everyone's okay with that. Or did I make total nonsense? And if so, people let me know.
I should raise my hand, but I'm. Can I just speak as long as I unmute?
Yeah, just go for it. It's hard to see when you're sharing screens.
So right. I had noticed that I think when Christina was making changes, she did them as edits as opposed to suggestions. I don't like the, you know, the pink edits. And in particular, what are we doing right now? Which one? Because you've got between 1.2.
Yeah, 1.2. I think there's a cluster of comments that relates broadly to advisor participation in the process.
Right.
And I think a lot of the comments relate to not having the advisors, you know, speak.
Right. And I think the advisors should be able to speak, whether they're actually counsel or, you know, some other advisor. So, I'd be okay with, I suppose, getting rid of or in addition, but the lower part, which isn't showing where it, there's the top part in terms of incapacity of counsel from complainant, but then there's also the change down on the next page, shall not participate actively in the conduct process. I think it's clearer to say the respondent support person shall not be a witness and shall not participate in the capacity of counsel, because the support person might participate in various ways that could be viewed as active. So I would leave it the way we had it.
Okay. Anyone else? Just go for it. Yeah, Barb.
I just want to clarify, should I then understand that people have read my comments? And where it says Christina, she entered them on my behalf after our office went through them. So these are comments from the Office of the Judicial Administrator, not Christina personally. But do I understand that people would prefer that I hold back and answer questions, if people have specific questions of our office that we would do that.
I think we're going to operate under the assumption that people have read each of these comments. And if people do have questions as to what we're doing, people can pose the question, then people can respond as we see fit going through it. I think that makes the most sense.
Then may I make just one general comment for all of these? I think it's really important to understand the overall objective is to make this process be less cumbersome and more straightforward for students. And I think there's disagreement about how to do that, but the whole idea of our comments behind that was to make this process more student focused and student centered and less legalistic, less like a judicial proceeding. Thank you.
Yep. And as we go through it and we take the votes, we're not going to make the changes right on the document. I'll do that later today, just so for ease of time, so we're not wordsmithing. We can look at that stuff tomorrow. But yeah, we have till 9:40 on this subject, but if people want to call the vote, call the vote. And that's kind of how we'll do it. I can't see people who want to raise their hands and stuff like that as well, so just talk if you want to talk too.
I'll call the question.
Okay. Is there a second? I'm assuming. Yeah.
Second, Laura.
Perfect. Thank you, Laura. So all in favor of, so the question is going to be basically, do the check mark yes if you want to keep it as is, and the check mark no if you want to incorporate the comment. So people can do that for me. Thank you. Andrea and, oh, here we go. In favor, perfect. And then Jen and then Mariah, waiting on your votes. Mariah, do you have a vote on this? Okay. That sounds good. And we will, I'll just put it as 5-1. If Mariah talks, I'll add to the vote. Okay. So that's the advisor speaking, and that's 5-1 on there. This kind of JCC one, so I think it is.
I'm sorry, Joe, but can you, when we do have a vote, if you could make clear what the vote is and what the outcome is, rather than sort of advisor speaking, is the vote positive in favor of leaving it as originally proposed?
Oh, yes, sorry about that. So it was 6-1 in favor of leaving it as originally proposed. So that's how it shook out. Now moving towards this one, let me see if I can pull out a question. So, I'm sorry, can the Barb, can you explain a bit on the 1-4, the Office of Judicial Codes Counselor, what your comments were going for?
Sorry, I have to look at it on a different screen because I can't really see. So this is, again, it's kind of related to the role of JCCs. And I thought we talked about this last time, but again, our concern is no absolutely great respect for JCC's current and prior. But if the idea is to make this process less legalistic and more student-centered, we do not believe that the only people on campus who can serve as JCCs are law students. And we believe that, and again, this is in a bigger context of a large, you know, anticipated revision and restructuring, a fundamental restructuring of this. So it is related to the concept of what should the role be of the JCC. We think there should be, you know, greater opportunity for more people to serve as advisors in what we understood was the goal and anticipate being a less legalistic campus conduct process.
Okay, great. Gabrielle, and I'll give this discussion till 9:45.
I don't want to repeat too much that we discussed last week, but I just want to emphasize that because, and please anyone ask questions about the office, I think it's very confusing sometimes to understand how the office functions, but essentially we interview first year law students at the end of their first year and hire them in anticipation for their second year. We do this in coordination with, like members of the UA who come and serve on the interview process, panels. We work with the dean of students in the law school. So it's a very open process within the law school. We then essentially the first year, I mean, we allow students some time for training, but because our office is so small and because we change over people like every other year, essentially, there's always a new group. Or every year there's a new group to train. We just don't have time to train people for, you know, a couple of months. I know that the JA's office opened up for graduate help this year, which was awesome. But I know that the training process there was very extensive and there were a lot of opportunities for those students to, I think, like understand how things work before jumping in. That's just really not possible with our office. And so I worry that when opening it up to a broader community, I think that other students could absolutely do it, but I worry that they wouldn't be able to jump in as quickly as we feel comfortable just because it is familiar to things that we're taught. It's very similar to like clinics that we do. A lot of the JCCs feel like it mirrors their clinic work. And so I don't think it goes to like student capabilities at all on campus generally. There are fundamentals to the job that we just don't have time to teach. I also, like I mentioned last time, like there are other complicating factors like conflicts of interest and things like that, that it's not just things that can be really taught given the time that we have. And given the resources in our office. And I mean, I think that there are other avenues if students want a less, you know, if they don't want a law student assisting them. The student advocates have started on campus. Those are an undergrad group of students who, you know, say that they advise on these kinds of processes in a confidential way. And so there are other mechanisms, but knowing that there is an office that is a continuous policy expert on these sorts of issues and has the background training for that, I do really think that is important. Yeah, and if people have questions just, I guess, about like generally how the office works, I'm happy to answer them.
Yeah, so the question that we'll be discussing is basically, should only law students serve as JCCs, or should we just open it up to anyone who could potentially be eligible through an application process that mirrors what we have now? So Jen?
I would say, just in addition to what Gabrielle said, there's actually a whole field of people that have been trained specifically in student support, in student development, that would be excellent advocates and advisors. you know, my background, my master's, my doctorate is all in student development, student support, all of that. And they can also be really good resources through a process that is developmental and educational. And sometimes there is the piece of support that students need that can be provided by people that aren't law students, and in a different way. Like, I know that my training and my education is very different than Gabrielle's, right? Like, how I would approach supporting a student through a process like this is probably different, not for any reason other than I've been trained to support students in an educational and developmental way. Not saying that Gabrielle hasn't, or the JCC, I shouldn't use you, Gabrielle, you know, that role hasn't been trained, but they've been trained in a very different way. And I think there's a lot of value in a student code that allows that for somebody like myself, not me, like, but somebody that's been trained and is in student affairs and has a passion for this work to really support students through this process and can be an expert on the code, can be an expert on student development and where they are in their growth through a college environment, and can really do a great job. I think about even in 6.4 is what we call it at Cornell, advocates and advisors. I mean, students can have a person of choice with them, and it could be me. You know, it doesn't have to be a JCC recommend, you know, representing them. Sorry, my son is like leaving the office. So I really would push towards, you know, having it be anybody that the student wants and not just a JCC. And that training is essential. And I would even say, now that I've heard this, and I don't want to say it out loud, but I think there's a piece of training the JCC should get on student development and student development theory. And maybe you do, and I don't know. But that would be an important piece of this process as well.
Great. Risa, and then Gabrielle.
Yeah, I had to unmute myself. I'm looking at like multiple documents so that I can actually read them. So in the earlier piece that we just voted on, we voted to keep the statement about the JCC as an alternative or in addition to utilizing an advisor offered by the university. The respondent has the right to select and consult with an advisor of their own choosing. So that seems to cover some of the issues that are being raised, particularly by Jen. And so this provision that we're looking at right now has to do with the JCC's office. It seems to me the question, I just want to make sure I'm clear on what we're talking about, the question of who gets to participate as a representative in the hearing. And so I'm just looking for the language. I'm just trying to figure out what, in fact, we're voting on specifically.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, so what we're specifically voting on is going to be the position of JCC and those who can serve in the office of the Judicial Codes Counselor, or whatever we're changing it to. So what we're voting on is, should it be that only law students should serve as a JCC, or should we open up that process to any other student, whether they be graduate, undergraduate student? And that's the question.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it seems like Gabrielle's point about the sort of the feasibility of it is actually quite important, that if you're going to have a JCC's office, that office should be one that actually has training of a certain type. I mean, there may be some people who could do a really good job in the OJA's office, you know, but it doesn't make sense to just say, well, anybody who wants to do it should be able to, you know, to apply to do it necessarily. And the fact that students who are respondents can have other advisors does, or other support persons and advisors, you know, enables them to do that. It's just a question of who's in the JCC's office having that particular role. And I you know, I think that what Gabrielle said makes a lot of sense in terms of the training issues.
Okay. Gabrielle, then Jen, and then vote on this question.
Yeah, I don't want to. So I think that there's two separate kind of things to consider here. One is who can be an advisor and who should be a JCC. So who can be an advisor is anyone under the code. Anyone can be an advisor, a support person. So these individuals who are student advocates or people who are more, you know, trained on the sort of developmental aspects of student education, they can still be advisors, but the question is just who should be a JCC, which I don't think that this discussion, this discussion also calls into question who should be a JCC for policy 6.4. And although, again, there may be amazing advocates on campus, that doesn't prevent them from serving as an advisor for someone. It just would keep them from representing the Office of the Judicial Codes Counselor or whatever the name is. And in policy 6.4, I mean, I don't want to take this too far outside of this code, but it is so different from the Campus Code of Conduct, and that legal background is just crucial. And we work with attorneys who use us as policy experts and who use us as experts of 6.4 and how it operates on the ground. And I really worry about introducing people without that background into the policy 6.4 arena. And I do think that this change would open that up because there can't be two JCC offices. Not that there can't, but I highly doubt there would be like funding and support for that from the university.
Okay. Jen, did you have something? No. Kat, did you have something?
Sure. So I completely agree with Gabrielle. I think that this job of the JCC will take a lot of training. I just think that there's no reason that undergrads or other folks shouldn't be able to undertake that kind of training. I think if you really want an educational and a developmental kind of code, I think we see a lot of student ignorance, and by getting students into a position where they're going to actually understand the code and be able to provide counseling for their peers is going to make it a lot more friendly to undergrads. People won't be so scared of the process. I think you often see from the JCCs a very legalistic kind of proceeding. I think just having undergrads or anyone who wants to serve in this capacity able to do so would just make it a more friendly code. You can see peers helping peers. You'll see just like wider spread of education, less misinformation about the code if we're able to have students to actually get involved in this process. But that's just me.
Okay, so it is past that 9:45 deadline and I don't have anyone else to talk about this unless people want to. So happy to entertain a call to question on should only law students serve as JCCs? We can just go into the vote. Yeah, so we'll just go into the vote, it's fine. So for those who do the check mark yes if you want only law students to serve as JCCs, and do the red X if you think it should be open to anyone. Okay, by a vote of 4-3 on this one, we're going to leave this as is, and so that means that only law students will serve as JCCs. So that is the result of that vote. So this will fill in my... And I think because there are check marks and chat features that, yes, people can understand who like specifically is voting which way, if people are catching that. But in the final vote, you know, in the reports that get produced, I'm just going to put it as a number if that's okay with everyone. But if someone wants to be and wants to say, here's what I personally believe, like if they want to put their name next to the vote, or put their name on certain votes and everything like that, I'm allowing that. So as transparent as you want to be with your votes, you're allowed to be. So yes. So blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to find the next kind of big comment on everything and manage. Blah, blah, blah. So if someone can help me to find the next big vote, that would be really helpful to me just because I'm managing how many different parts. If someone wants to call something out. Okay. So the next one that I'm seeing, if people want to go into it, it's the kind of conversation around looking at student conduct on people who go on to abroad expeditions, study abroad, study abroad stuff. So that's kind of section 2.1. Christina has a comment there from the OJA's office, basically that people in the, how should we call it, in study abroad in international affairs, they want, you know, if people do have a campus code violation, that there should be some sort of jurisdiction or some sort of way to do it. I don't know if this is so much of an OPA discussion. So Barb, can you explain this one a little bit more? I'm so sorry.
That's okay. The question is whether the code is sufficiently worded now to make it clear that when students are in a study abroad program, whether that's a short-term immersion or or a longer program, whether they are subject to the campus code of conduct. This question was raised to me by an individual in the International Travel Health and Safety Office, and the comment was faculty are not certain that the code applies to students who are in study abroad programs, and the faculty would like for that to be clear. I am trying to be just an honest reporter of the comment that was made to me. I think it goes to what the definition of a student is in the code, and you know, that would be the place to deal with it.
Okay, Laura.
So I work in the Office of Global Learning, and I agree that there needs to be a way of extending this to students who are on study abroad programs, short-term exchange programs, that sort of thing. So I do think this is something that we should vote on. The comments here just sort of clarify that we're extending the code. So I think that's important to do.
I personally think it might already be clear, but I defer to people who think if it isn't clear, we should do what we can to make it even more clear.
Okay, Risa.
I haven't gone back to look at the language in the document we already voted on, but I thought we had this discussion. I thought it was clear. I mean, I have no problem with clarifying things if they're not clear, but I that was my understanding, was that the initial, you know, substantive document that we've already voted on, I thought made clear about this, the code extending to all programs, including, you know, study abroad. But if there's, so I guess perhaps what's being raised is whether they're Cornell or not Cornell study abroad programs, does the code apply? Is that the question? Like it might be through another university's study abroad program. And is that the ambiguity? I'm just trying to understand what the ambiguity is.
No, I don't think there's any ambiguity. I'm just looking at this text that's up on the screen, and you know, this is what we're talking about, right, on the screen. So if we're voting, I think the text on the screen here is just, it's in line with what we decided before and who's subject. Right, we're just making sure the text here's in line with that, and it should be a pretty easy an easy vote, right?
I mean, it says student, you know, so I thought student would refer, because it's going to be one document, right? The substantive code plus the procedures. So if it's just a matter of clarifying, I think we're all in agreement.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. I thought the original the first document had made that clear.
Yeah, I think that's something, I think that's true. I don't have it up on the screen or in my memory, so, but I think that's true. And I think since everyone decided the substantive portion of it, that it includes students on study abroad, we can move on from this one and just say that, and if it doesn't, we can go back to the substantive document at a later date, and I'll make a note of that for everyone, and we can move on. So that we will move on. So Barb, if you want to explain this one and then to see if there's a question for the committee, and then we'll go on. It's the one in 2.2, the limitations period.
So basically we think that that students should be subject to the code for actions that occur whenever they're students. So that there should not be a limitation period, you know, within 1 year for a student who remains at the university. There may be practical reasons why a complaint outside of a year can't be pursued, but there may be very good reasons why a complainant didn't come forward. It might be that the information wasn't known to either the complainant or to a university official, and you know, we think there should be more flexibility in terms of the limitations period. I think last time we started to talk about whether that could be addressed as an exception, I don't think that we resolved that.
Okay. So the question that I guess I'll pose to the committee is, should there or should there not be a limitations period? And we'll discuss that one until 10:10, if everyone's okay with that. Yeah, Risa.
I didn't understand the OJA's position that there shouldn't be a limitations period at all. I thought we were talking more in terms of how should that be interpreted as a limitations period. Because a limitations period gives people, you know, notice of the parameters in which they're going to be judged. And also it guards against, you know, stale evidence, people leaving, you know, it puts pressure on the OJA's office, as it should be, to go ahead and act in an expeditious manner. My reading of this provision is that it already includes an exception. It's not of the type that Barb's talking about. It's not that it's that we would need to write it in there, but it says at the very last paragraph that the basically the OJA's office can request to extend the limitations period if they've got a good reason to do it. And one of those reasons I imagine could be, well, we could not have gotten this evidence before and it just came to light, and therefore in the interest of, you know, of applying the code fairly and thoroughly, we need an extension.
Okay. Barb, could you clarify a bit more? Maybe my question is bad. The question isn't accurate in describing the OJA's stance.
Yeah, so two other pieces. If you feel, I'm not gonna, I don't think we need to belabor the debate. The question is whether you think it's the provision in the last bullet is sufficient. I guess it's two other points. In the second bullet, the question is, I think, a problematic one of a bigger issue in the code, which is stating that ordinarily Cornell is going to wait until final disposition of prosecutions. That can be a very, very long time. And we have real concerns about whether that's in the best interests of the university to continue that practice. We would propose flipping that to say that ordinarily the university will proceed. You know, understanding that if we're requested to hold off for a reasonable period of time while a police investigation is happening, we would do that but that, and we appreciate that that sometimes puts students in a challenging position, but to say that the university can't proceed with a campus conduct proceeding when there is a criminal prosecution underway really, in my opinion, makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for the university to address the campus, the community issues here on our campus. The final point I'd make that's in the comment is the question of whether there should be any limitations period with respect to organizations who continue to, especially registered organizations who continue to exist and function kind of despite past bad behaviors. That could be the case. So we're proposing that in the case of student organizations, the university should be able to look at the alleged misconduct whenever it's reported.
Okay, so I will change my question to address the second bullet first, the one in which there's a public prosecution. So the question there is, do you agree with the current language as stated, or do you think that the university should not be required to wait until criminal matters are resolved in order to proceed? So that's the question we'll focus in on for this part of it, just to amend my earlier one. Bryce?
Yeah, so what's weird about this is that, again, and maybe I'm just echoing what Risa said, I don't read this as saying that at all. It just says a charge may be brought within 60 calendar days. So to me, that's saying that that although ordinarily a respondent has to be filed within 1 year, a charge could be brought within 60 calendar days of the disposition of prosecution, so public prosecution. So that doesn't seem to preclude a charge from, or a complaint from being filed earlier.
Okay.
I think it relates back to the definition of jurisdiction that's in the other part of the code that we're not looking at. That's where the ordinarily Cornell will wait language appears, I believe. Somebody else can correct me on that if I'm wrong.
I actually would propose, in the interest of time, that we flag this as something that we should check on in terms of its correspondence to the other document and go back to it tomorrow so we could move on.
Okay, I will do that. I think that makes a lot of sense.
So I actually was wondering, though, there was a lot in that section, in the limitation section, and there it sounds like to me there could have been multiple questions, and it makes sense that perhaps mm-hmm. this, should we wait for the criminal prosecution process to be done? But I think the question about this, the 1 year with the extension versus no limitations, or for as long as, you know, a respondent is part of our community, I don't know if that is ready for a vote. Just throwing that out there.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I'm trying to get my head organized around all these questions, and sometimes it's hard as I'm doing it. Is there like from the OJA's office, is there like an ideal that you all believe in? I guess that's the only way I'll phrase, or anyone, and I'm not going to just frame as the OJA, or anyone believe, like, should there be no limitations period, anything on this?
We don't think that, we think limitations periods are good and they're understandable. I guess what we would prefer to see is something that says, that provides more flexibility up front to know that an extension could be granted as long as a student remains a student at Cornell. Understanding that if something happened when they're a freshman and somebody brings it up as a senior, there will be very real reasons why the office might choose not to proceed, including the evidence is stale, people have graduated, all the reasons why you have limitations periods. So, again, this is not one, honestly, where I feel as strongly about as others. So if you believe that the final bullet provides the flexibility to cover, you know, alleged misconduct by, you know, that for example, what I just said wouldn't hold true because you couldn't extend it for more than 6 calendar months. So something happens when somebody's, you know, in their first year here and it doesn't come up. It has to come up at least before they're it has to come up at least in their second semester of their sophomore year for the JA's office to be able to look at it, even if the two students are both still here.
Okay. Risa?
I still think we should just take this limitations period and deal with it tomorrow. I'd like to also look at that provision and compare what we currently have. And I just feel like, you know, that question of should we build in more flexibility is one where I need to compare what we've got now, look at the substantive provisions and what we have in there, and then see if there's some place where we can build in more flexibility that meets the issues that the OJA's office is raising right now.
Okay. I will put that for tomorrow then. and we'll move on from this. So I will move on to this comment within 2.4, notice of formal investigations. There are two, so I'll start with the first one. The OJA's position is, you know, or the comment is the Cornell email should be a sufficient method of communication, or as all students are required to have it. And then as it stands, it says the notice must be provided by Cornell in writing and by secure email if possible. So I'll give, you know, a couple minutes for discussion on that one till, you know, 10:15 if people are sooner, if people just say, you know what, that makes sense. So as people feel the need to discuss this one. If people don't have anything, we can just call the question on it and vote.
So Joe, I just have one comment about this. So this is saying that Cornell can provide the notice only by email if we accept this modification, right?
I think it's just the baseline from what I'm reading. The baseline of this comment would be that email would just be fine. So if they wanted to, you know, do more communications, the OJA's office could. But the baseline of what the OJA would have to do would just be send it to the student's Cornell email address.
Okay, so my only concern about that is occasionally emails slip by. And so I think probably notice should be provided by in writing too.
Okay, Gabrielle.
So the secure email was to try to balance both like having a written form and an email, because as Bryce said, emails can get lost, but the secure mail, that's how Title IX like sends any documents. So they'll send like an email to the respondents or the complainants and say like, you have a document waiting for you in like the Cornell files. I think it's a better mechanism because then the office can actually see if the student opened the document or not. Whereas with email, there isn't that possibility.
Okay, Christina.
So the current notice letter, which is what provides the student notice, is sent in that way. It is sent through the secure software that both Title IX's office and we use. So I just want to clarify is the first point of contact from the JA's office right now is generally from Steve, our administrative assistant, who's saying, we are looking to schedule an appointment with you. And without getting into too much of the weeds, I'm just trying to clarify, is it the expectation from this provision that every communication is coming from that secure messaging? That's the piece that I'm trying to clarify, because any type of, when we're communicating, you know, Cornell member to Cornell community member, we communicate vast amounts of secure information through regular email. And so I'm wondering if it's further complicating things in some ways, because when we send it through secure, the secure software, students have to log in once more to get into the letter. So I'm just putting it out there that it's another additional step if we're trying to simplify things.
Gabrielle.
I get that it creates an additional step for students, but it does make that initial notice a little more, not serious, but I just think it does what it's supposed to do, because when students just get an email from Steve, it just says, please contact me to schedule an appointment. It doesn't say, it just says that the students are responding. It doesn't say what the behavior was. It doesn't say when the allegations essentially occurred. And so by this, to me, it actually simplifies the process, because the student would be able to get the notice right away. The JA's office would understand whether or not the student actually opened the notice, and if they need to contact the student in other ways. So I actually think it simplifies the process, even if it adds an additional step.
Okay, Barb.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. I thought this provision was about the notice of a formal complaint and investigation. A phone call telling people that they're gonna be, that they need to make an appointment, that's not the kind of notice that we're talking about here. And I thought the question was whether or not we have to send them a physical letter as well as an email, a secure email, or whether the secure email is enough.
Lisa?
Well, as proposed by the OJA's office, it removes the secure email part. And this only applies to the notice. It says this notice. So it's not generally about mail, it's about this notice. So the secure email seems very important here for the notice, for all the reasons given, including, sort of a privacy issue of not just dumped into your email. By the way, there's a formal charge against you. And the in writing seems like a pretty minor additional step for just this notice. It's not all communications. So it seems to me that the gravity of it does come home to somebody, who's charged, if they get it this way.
Yeah, but.
Sorry, so we send communications through Maxient, which tells people to go to, that they can pick up a letter. And as Gabriella said, that email lets us know whether a student has actually received it, which is very helpful. I would respectfully, you all have to decide whether doing written letters is significant or not. I would respectfully suggest that by the time students get a notice of a formal complaint, we have told them that they should expect to receive communications from our office via email, and they should check their emails regularly.
Right.
So if we're using the secure email system, though, doesn't that mean that a form was already, a formal letter was already drafted on letterhead? And I assume then they're getting an email that they then click a link and log in to get this document. And so if that's true, then first of all, I think secure needs to be remain in the text here to be consistent with OJA's recommendation. And secondly, then it sounds like there might be a disagreement here on whether we also send a letter in writing. But in that case, if it's already a formal letter, then it's really just a matter of, do they print it out and put it in the mail, which is an additional cost for the university. And I guess I'm wondering what happens if, you send this and they never open the secure email. What does OJA just keep sending emails? I mean, it may be a moot point, because if we do it secure email, then presumably you actually know whether they've, opened the email. I guess my only concern is whether, what happens next if they don't respond? Because I would like to know that.
So if students don't respond, we do follow up by additional emails and or by a telephone call to make sure that they've received it. Sometimes if we know that they're working with a JCC, we may involve the JCC or the JCC, Christina can correct me if I'm wrong, but would be typically be copied at that point. Or if not, if we knew they were working with a JCC, we would let the JCC know that we were having trouble contacting the student. On the question of secure email, I just need clarity. We believe that using Cornell's email system is a secure system because students are required to have email, they're required to password protect themselves, and our policies prohibit them from sharing their passwords with other people. So if by secure email you mean something more than that, we need clarification on that. And perhaps the funds to cover it.
Well, I was understanding secure email as what you just described. It sounds like somebody's told it's in, I don't know that term, you know, of Maxwell, whatever it was called, but it sounded like from what you were saying, it's sort of like sometimes we'll get a notice of here's something that's confidential and it's found in what I always forget what these things are called. You know, it's not Box, it's the other one that's a secure system. And you go in and use your password and there's the document. That's what I understood this to mean. Is that, I mean, it sounds like you're already doing that.
Maybe I'll let Christina answer this.
So I think, Risa, what you're describing is Dropbox. And it's Maxient is this software that we use to disseminate notice letters, which is exactly what Gabrielle was describing before. It generates an email to a student's inbox that says, hey, you have corresponded through the Maxient system from the Office of the Judicial Administrator. Click here, log in to retrieve the letter. And that's what the student would do to receive the notice letter. The notice letter is what has the charges, the fact that you are a respondent, occurring on this potential date, here's the process, you have the right to a JCC, we look forward to hearing from you. That's what the notice letter says. And that is already sent through what I interpret as the secure email, as opposed to copy and paste right into the text of an email. I would say that the notice that a student is required to come into the JA's office to meet with us, that's a regular text email. It's a one-liner from our admin who says, hey, please give me a call to schedule that meeting. Those are the two different communications that might make it a little bit confusing right now for us. So hopefully that clarifies it.
Bryce.
So I would suggest that we just vote on whether it should be in writing, and we remove the strikeout of secure, since it sounds like the office is already prepared to continue that. If Barbara agrees.
I think I agree that what we do now is secure email.
Okay. I think we all agree that part works then. And so it seems like the only question is mm-hmm. in writing versus not in writing, in addition to the secure email.
And
okay.
Can I so, ask
yeah, Christina.
If in what does in writing mean then? So the question that you posed was should we vote on the in writing piece? So if you can elaborate, maybe your interpretation of what in writing means. Is it physical letter? What does that mean?
Yeah. So and honestly, I'm not taking a strong position on this. Although I thought it made sense to, at the same time you're creating this thing that's put in the Maxient system, that you print it out and put it in an envelope and send it to the student's mailbox.
So I guess that is how I'll interpret it when it says in writing for the question, in writing being the physical thing that is mailed to a student. So that's how I'll pose the question to the committee, and I'll ask the committee to vote on that now. So check the green yes if you are okay with as written on the procedures saying in writing, and if you put the red X if you don't want that part in the procedures. So if people can vote on that now, that would be great.
So just to clarify, we're just talking about removing in writing.
Yes, that is correct.
But we're voting yes if we don't want to remove it.
That, yeah, yeah. So green if you want to keep it as is, and red if you want to take that part out. Okay, by a vote of 4-2-2, in writing is going to stay in the procedure. So keep it as is. Okay. And so then we have this other one. It is in some multi-responding cases, hazing, et cetera, providing this notice within 7 days could be problematic. So that will be the question, you know, should it stay as 7 days? Or should it be extended? I don't know, Barb, if there was if you just wanted to remove it entirely or just increasing the threshold to a certain number.
I did not have a chance to look, and I'm sorry, to see what the code currently provides. Maybe this is what it provides, but it's so hard, I have to say, because we trust that we make decisions as promptly and judiciously and fairly as we can. And I think part of this whole process assumes that the JA's office does not do that, and therefore you need checks on everything that we do. I think, honestly, what has the language that we would prefer is that notice must be provided by Cornell promptly when you've determined that there's sufficient evidence to move forward. We don't have the resources. When we have a large, for example, there's a big hazing case that comes into our office, for example, we don't have the resources to, you know, stop everything that we're doing and devote all of our investigative resources to that one case. So to say that within, you know, 7 calendar days, within 1 week, that's not even 7 business days. So 5 business days, the office has to have investigated and made a determination about whether to notify a student that they're gonna be subject to an investigation, I think that's onerous on our office, and I think does a disservice to students who will, because I suspect we will err on the side of notifying students, this has happened, you may, you may be subject to this investigation. So if somebody files a formal complaint, we have 7 days, as I read this, to send a notice that there's been a formal complaint. And that doesn't give us enough time in significant cases to determine whether there's sufficient evidence there.
Okay. Initial thoughts from anyone? So the question is going to be, do you want to keep it within 7 days, or do you want to just provide a kind of broad guidance? So Risa.
Yeah, thanks. Just looking at the language again. I think there are possibly alternatives we can have, but I would just point out that this is a notice of a formal complaint and investigation after the initial inquiry kind of an initial, you know, investigation has been done, because it says after an initial inquiry of a complaint or report, I'll just use OJA for our purposes, will determine whether there's reasonable cause to believe that a violation has occurred. So that's after that initial inquiry. It's not just, oh, somebody files a complaint and then boom. So there has been some work done And it seems reasonable to ask the OJA's office to have some period of time to put it in there, you know, to within which somebody should be notified of that there's initiation of a formal complaint, not just simply an initial inquiry or an initial complaint that's not a formal one, or a report that's not a formal complaint. But, you know, perhaps we could say something like promptly, comma, ordinarily within 7 calendar days, something like that would make it softer.
I don't think I would know what that meant, promptly or narrowly within 7 days. I wouldn't know what that meant.
Well, it sounds like promptly and ordinarily I would take to mean when it's not ordinarily possible, then it can be longer. Or, I mean, well, you know, I don't think promptly does it. I don't think I know exactly what promptly means. I know that I think, I might think that 3 days is promptly. I might argue that 5 days is promptly. But what we're saying is ordinarily, this is what we mean by promptly.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I did not hear ordinarily. I heard something else.
Well, I said ordinarily, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's fine.
Okay. If people are okay with that language, I'll put that as a reply to the comment. We can move on from it.
Seven calendar days.
Okay. There we go. Everyone's okay with that. I'll move on. That's just a language thing. People are okay with that, and then consider this. Barb, in the last kind of 4 minutes, if you can explain this comment on 251, and that kind of explanation of this comment will kind of end today, if that's okay.
So I guess the question, the broader question is, what should the review process be for interim measures? And there's a later comment about temporary suspensions, which are a form of interim measures. And the question is just, this is, it's a very, to me, this is a, if we're looking to, at places to simplify things for students, this seems like a place where there's a lot of language and a lot of, you know, specifics written in here, and whether or not that could be simplified and leave it to the Vice President for Student and Campus Life as the person who would review imposition of interim measures.
Okay, we have 2 minutes left, and so I'll leave it there. So obviously today, not like the most organized in the sense of, you know, talking and voting, but just because I'm kind of doing it on the fly. So what I'm going to request everyone just to prepare for tomorrow's meeting is by, you know, if possible, by 3 p.m. today, if you have final remaining comments on this document that you want to add as like, I don't understand this, or can this be a question or something like that, if you could please just add that, you know, by 3 p.m. today, so that I can then have time to, you know, take all of these questions and, you know, produce the agenda for tomorrow with each of these questions and each of these comments kind of put onto the agenda, so that we know exactly what we're doing. And so I can time out the meeting as best as possible, so we can say, okay, here's the question we're going to discuss that's in this section from this comment for tomorrow, so that everyone has kind of like the itinerary of how each vote is going to be scheduled out for tomorrow. Is that would be amazing and very helpful for me, so that people will know exactly, and so that people know exactly what's going to happen. I'll be sending an email out basically to everyone through the listserv saying, you know, exactly what I'm saying now, like by 3 p.m., put your final comments onto the procedures document. And then by 5 p.m. today, I'll have the agenda out to everyone that looks at all the votes that we'll be taking for tomorrow during the day. So everyone knows what they're getting them into so that people can prepare tonight into tomorrow. And I understand it's a time crunch and this is not the best of all the circumstances. And so for that, I personally apologize, but that would be, I think, the best plan of attack. So now that we know exactly what we're doing, if that makes sense to everyone.
Yeah. Joe, can I just ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Do you know if the, whoever controls the, you know, University Assembly's page has put tomorrow's meeting up there? Because we usually advertise it's public.
I don't believe that has went out yet. If anyone from the OA is on the call, if you could say that real quick. If not, I'll be sure to, there's a chat. Okay, I just put it up early this morning. Okay, perfect. Right. And then if that Zoom invite from the OA could get sent out to the committee, that would be great. But yes, that is up on the site, so yes.
Thank you. We can make sure that that gets pushed out today.
Perfect. Thank you. So yes. So by 3 p.m., final comments on this document so that I can, by 5 p.m., send out the agenda for Saturday, and I'll be sending that to the listserv. Thank you, everyone. I really appreciate all the hard work and all the time crunch and all the dedication, and I can't say that enough. So I look forward to seeing everyone tomorrow morning via Zoom at 11 a.m.
Great. Thanks. Bye. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.